So I often have to script out my first two sentences that I know I'm going to say, because otherwise I'll just start like rattling off super quick. But thank you so much as leaders being here. We used to broaden this to say pastors and leaders, but over the course of time we started seeing so many leaders from the world of business and education, and even a little bit from politics, realizing that leadership and kingdom leadership is not exclusive to the church. Now, the church should be the best at it, and it pains me to admit that the church has not been very great at leadership, and business almost took it on and moved it forward. And I believe that that part of a major revival is in the sector of business. I believe that because the amount of impact a business can have on a city, and the amount of impact a business can have on people's lives. I mean, if you've just got 10 employees, you are touching 10 families. Even if the person is single, 10 lives. If a large, let's say like a manufacturer, moves into a community and adds immediately 150 jobs, that shifts economies. And if you have any amount of employees, even one, you are responsible for the environment that they will spend nearly a third of their life in. You have more potential for ministry impact than I do in a session of talking or taking a podium once a week. And so I believe I'm a little bit on a mission to take the word ministry and stop making it synonymous with church work or nonprofit work. But ministry being far more about how you do whatever it is you do. And so today, what I want to talk about in teamwork is something, it's pretty simple. It can have some doctrinal depth that I won't go too much into. But it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple to say. It's pretty simple to talk about. It's pretty simple to explain for the most part. But it has immense implications on your effectiveness and how you glorify God. Because I'm assuming if you're here, whatever business you are in, whatever responsibility you have, I imagine at some level you want to glorify God in that. I mean, the people I know already that I see in here, there's childcare facilities, there's coffee shop owners, there's realtors. I mean, I see all a bunch of different industries in here, and the amount of impact you can have by taking whatever that is that God has put you in and glorifying God in that, that's incredible. And teamwork is something that, like, I breathe that. It is a passion of mine. It is such a wiring, I can't help but talk and think about team. And I don't know why God wired me that way, but he did. And so of all the things I would love to talk about, all the things that I know is important and would love to teach you, I want to narrow the focus to one dynamic that I feel like is it might not be the first domino that knocks over a lot of other dominoes, but it's one of the first. And that is the interpersonal dynamic work of team. The relationships. Now, if you think of any organization, any business, any nonprofit, any church, for that matter, a kingdom, it is a network of relationships. Okay, so even if you're an entrepreneur, at some point, for your entrepreneurial work to survive, you have to have a client. You need clients and customers to survive in business, or you don't have a business. You just have a good idea. At some point, an idea has to find itself manifested in some type of product or service that you're delivering where you need clients and customers. If you're in some type of production, you're going to have, you know, vendors, or you're going to have the support network necessary in your supply chain to get what you need to produce the product to deliver it. If you're in services, you're limited by your own self. So eventually, if you're good at what you do, if you're like in contract work, then you're going to have subcontractors or employees that are a part of being a subcontractor. And so you have relationships. How do we work inside those relationships, and how do we take responsibility for our part of that relationship so that that business that is the network of relationships can glorify God? And I loosely just call this concept face-to-face. And it comes from the book of Exodus. You can go there. It'll be on the screen. Exodus chapter 25, just a few verses here. This is Moses on the mountain communing with God, and God is giving him instructions about the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. And so he finishes instructions about the Ark of the Covenant, and then God says this to Moses. You shall make a, this is verse 17 of Exodus 25. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, and other measurements, and and you shall make two, have you read some of this list of stuff? Yeah. And you shall make two, this is not even in, like, real measurements. Like the metric system. Come on, that's not real. I'm sorry, online church, I'm really sorry. I got it, I'm American, and I'm sorry about that. Okay, and you shall make, this is important, you shall make two cherubim of gold, and of hammered work you shall make them. On the two ends of the mercy seat, make one cherub on the one end and one cherub on the other end. Of one piece with the mercy seat shall you make the cherubim on its two ends. The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. Their faces one to another. Toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony. I will speak with you about all that I will give you in command for the people of Israel. All right, again, it's worth the time another time to trace doctrinally all of this and all the symbolism there. But one simple element that I want you to see is that the design of the mercy seat was putting two cherubim face to face. And that face to face created a space that was sacred. A space that was sacred for God to commune with his people, for God to speak, and for God to be present. And what it symbolizes, and I'll just trace it to one place, what it symbolizes is that face-to-face relationships create a sacred space for God's presence, his voice, his word, his instruction, and his power that alone does not exist. Is there a measure of God's presence you can experience by yourself? Absolutely. Absolutely. But God designed humanity to require relationship for his image to be seen clearly, for his glory to be revealed in its fullness. And this comes from understanding what are humans and what are humans for. Genesis 1, some of the most basic and probably verses you would have memorized very early, Genesis 1, 26, God says, "And let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion." Let us, God, one, also speaking of a plurality within the Godhead. God exists, just Trinitarian theology, sorry here. Okay, so God exists in eternal communion of love with himself. The Godhead is a network of interpersonal relationships that creates one God, three persons. And let us make man in our image and after our likeness. And so what are humans for? To have dominion. To image God into the world as stewards of his creation. To be in partnership with God to rule and reign in this world. Have dominion. And then verse 27, a little poem. If your Bible is kind of more literal translation, you'll see it kind of blocks out in a little poem. And God made man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. One humanity, one image, two expressions. And so immediately you see, and again, this is this, you can work all of this down to an immense doctrinal depth, okay? So what I'm saying, I can do that, just not today. Immediately, to image God requires relationship. And the image of God is not something we have, it's something we are. And there is a part of God that I as an image-bearing creature, can reveal. But immediately from the beginning, one humanity, but two expressions to be one in having dominion. God is one, and yet somehow we see just here at the very beginning, more than one. And mankind is one, and yet more than one. And so there exists this triad of relationship and partnership. And you can immediately see right there at verse 28 how that relationship and partnership is necessary. He says, and he blessed them, and he said the fivefold vocation of man, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now at a base literal level, he's saying, there's children here. Be married and do what married people do and have babies. And fill the earth. And I had five, and I'm like, all right, I'm doing my part filling the earth. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion. To fulfill his command, being fruitful and multiplying, fill the earth, required more than one. Required that. And then, you know, if you fast forward all the way to Jesus, we see that in Christ, Paul gives us that revelation in Galatians that there's neither Jew nor Gentile, bond nor free. There is neither male and female, but all are one in Christ. And so to image God, to fulfill our vocation, can't do it alone. God embedded it within the design of humanity that you can't fulfill the fullness of his purpose by yourself. It requires relationship. And you can see that's what the enemy attacked in Genesis 3. When he tempted Eve, look at what the first result of that sin was. You have a face-to-face relationship with Adam and Eve. And it actually says in Genesis 2, that a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and the two shall become one. So, like, again, at the literal level in marriage, the two become one. One humanity, two expressions, the two becomes one. It's that unity that God's after, that partnership in relationship. And so what happens when they sin? They see each other naked, and what does it do? They felt they were ashamed. So what did they do? I guess in a literal sense, but you can see this in a deeper sense. When they sinned, what happened? They turned away from the relationship. They hid themselves. Covered themselves. And then, how did they turn to God? God shows up, Adam, where are you? And he says, I hid myself, for I was afraid. Shame and fear turns us away from the relationship. We turn away from each other, and we turn away from God, and sin there breaks that triad of partnership and begins to mar the image of God in mankind. You look at the sins that are traced there in early parts of Genesis. They're all sins against each other. Murder. Right after that, you have Lamech. He abuses women and murders. And you just see the downward spiral. It's all interpersonal sins. And so Jesus comes and he says, okay, Matthew 22, what does it mean to do everything God's called us to do? Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. In Matthew 22, in Mark's version, he adds, and strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. Keep a face-to-face relationship with God, love God, and love your neighbor. So I'm going to ask my wife to come. You need a visual. So this is my wife, Hannah. The other hero in our story. Okay, so this is just a visual. So we are called to be in relationship. And this would be very literal. We are married, so this is a covenantal relationship. If you're single, that doesn't mean in any way this gets diminished. You still have to be in relationships that have a level of intimacy that you can stay face-to-face. And so we have a face-to-face relationship, and the space that's created between us becomes sacred for God. It's a place, it creates a mercy seat for God's presence, His power, His voice, His direction that otherwise doesn't exist. It's not that God doesn't exist, and it is that God is holding back. It's that we aren't creating the space for that. And so what's important here is this relationship, this face-to-face relationship. But here's the deal. I'm still a pretty flawed individual. I might have come a long way, but I still say and do things that are less than smart. She's too kind to even amen that. But these two flawed, one more flawed than the other, individuals commit to a relationship to stay in this relationship no matter what. That's what we set at an altar and looked exactly like this and said, I do, to a covenant, right? Okay. But life happens, right? And you get busy. And I have a bad day, and I say something dumb pretty regularly. And what is the temptation? Because I put something into this relationship that wasn't God. It was sin. I wasn't being malicious about it. I just might have just popped off. The temptation is to turn away. Fine, be that way. And now to fill the space with other comments. And then what do? I get defensive from that. Fine, you be that way. And I turn away. What does that do to the space? Poisons it. And we lose something of the sacredness that's created here somehow because I have done something and it might not have been intentional, and now we've affected the relationship and one of us, just one of us, turned away. Now there's something about love here that's lost. It's not irredeemable, it's just not in existence. And this is our temptation with all of our relationships. When we're called to maintain these face-to-face relationships with our teammates, with our friends, with our coworkers, with our clients, with our vendors, with our subcontractors, maintain this face-to-face relationship, but we have a hard time accounting for the humanity of the other person. And we give in to the temptation to turn away from the relationship, and we lose something when that happens. Okay, you can go ahead and sit down, hon. Thank you. And so what is our commitment to that relationship? Well, if we're a follower of Jesus, Jesus outright told us what to do about that. In John 13, what does Jesus do? He, at the highest level of authority, at the beginning of John, it says he recognized that all authority had been given to him in the cosmos. And what was his immediate reaction? What was his immediate response to recognize divine authority? Takes off his the symbol of his authority, and he puts on a towel and he washes the feet. Who is he washing the feet of? It also says in the first few verses of John, he knew what was about to happen. So he can see the future. He knows he has divine authority, and he knows who he is. He's the Son of God. What does he do? He serves. He serves the people who will deny him, betray him, and abandon him. And what does he do with all that power, all that authority? He serves them. He maintains the face-to-face relationship when he knew that every single one of them, except for John cleverly puts himself at the cross where he's the one and only disciple that doesn't abandon Jesus, when he knows Peter will deny him, Peter will turn away, Judas will betray him, and everybody else will abandon him. He maintains because he knows there's something sacred here, so that when anyone turns, repents, anyone turns back, he has kept the space sacred. Okay, so now, okay, I got to jump really quick to so what we do as human beings, as husbands and wives, as friends, as children, as parents, as co-workers, as teammates, we take responsibility for our part of every relationship to stay face to face when everything in us wants to turn away. And a lot of times we have legitimate excuses too. Because they're jerks, right? I mean, have you ever had a relationship? Do you know people? It's hard. It's hard. And when you work together closely, it doesn't get easier. It's much harder. And so 1 John 4, we won't go there because I want to get to a little bit practically how this works out. But 1 John 4, specifically verses 7 to about 12, where John just begins to expound about love and how we who've received God's love are to pour. The Passion translation of those verses is quite incredible. We're to pour that love out. Pour that love out for one another. And anyone who is living that kind of love, it says in the Passion translation, has been fathered by God. And then it says how Jesus loved us sacrificially, how Jesus gave his life for us when we didn't deserve it. He served us when we didn't earn it. He loved us in spite of us. Because Jesus loved us that way, we're called to love one another. And it says if we love one another like that, God is among us. And his love, God's presence, God's spirit, his love comes to, and this is what it says, full expression in us. You cannot live that kind of reality in isolation. Because you don't really love one another from a distance. That's too safe. To love one another, it's got to be close quarters, which makes you very vulnerable, which means the possibility of getting hurt increases dynamically. And we have to be the kind of people who walk with security in who God's made us and maturity in where God's taken us to be present face to face to every one of those relationships. Now, it does not mean that you have to have a deep friendship that is just, you know, where you're always hanging out with one. No, no. You just have to stay face to face. Okay, so let me give you three very basic ideas. Again, this is super simple, but this is incredibly hard to work out in your day-to-day life. And working it out in your day-to-day life is very painful, and it will cost you a lot. And you're going to have to decide if it's worth paying the price or not. And I am fully committed to paying that price because I've seen the value. And it doesn't always happen immediately. Okay, so let me just give you these three and just expound a little bit on that. And I think the concept is enough for you. Getting this out. The first just principle of idea about this kind of face-to-face relationships and how that works in team. We're especially talking about a deeper level when it comes to your closest coworkers, your team, all right? That's a higher depth than like everyone else when it comes to where you're working and how you're working. The first one is that the relationship matters, not just the work. Okay, listen, your work matters, all right, unless it's sin. If what you do for a living is sin, stop. God will take care of you and get you another job or something. So if it's sin, stop. If it's not sin, your work matters. It's part of you fulfilling the human vocation of being fruitful, multiplying, filling the earth, subduing it, and having dominion. Anything you're doing that's contributing to the flourishing of humanity, that's ministry. That's ministry. It might not be nonprofit work. It might not be church work, but it's ministry. Okay? All right, you plumbing, that's ministry. All right? It's ministry. Okay. The work matters. And some of us, myself included, are wired for work. Wired for task. Wired for getting down to the work. Making something that matters. Doing something that matters. If you're familiar with the DISC profile, D personalities and C personalities are task-oriented. I personalities and S personalities are people-oriented. I don't register with any S in the DISC personality. And my I fluctuates a lot. I am very high C, very, in like just shy of OCD C personality, and a pretty high D personality. Like just the wiring of my personality, and to boot, if you're a Myers-Briggs type person, I registered at a 63% introvert. Okay? Now, okay, some members on my team registered an 89% introvert, okay? So 63% introvert. So which means I'm perfectly content being by myself, and when I'm working, I forget people exist. It's so Christ-like, isn't it? So I get that some people are just wired for that, okay? And some people, you're wired for relationship, and you just don't get a lot done because you're just with people all the time, and it's so exciting. Good for you. Oh, my gosh. So I get that, and I am not talking about personality types. That's not what I mean by this. What I mean is that the relationship matters in glorifying God. And if I accomplish the work but destroy a relationship, is it really worth it and is it really glorifying God? So just a basic, the relationship matters, not just the work. Your work matters, but make sure the relationships that are developed and necessary for the work, those are healthy too, and you stay face to face. You stay face-to-face with them. The second thing as a leader, this is going to require some self-awareness. You'll get it by concept because the principle, it's self-evident. It's obvious. Your attitude and your behaviors, your words and your actions, your attitude and your behaviors affect the relationship. I mean, you're like, well, duh, of course. Yeah. And you go to work like 40 to 60 hours a week. And every minute of that, your attitude and your behaviors are affecting the relationships. And so do you have the kind of relationships, have you developed the kind of trust and safety in the relationships where you're allowed to be human and you give allowances for people to have bad days and you work with one another in an effort to continue to improve that? But do not think that you getting your job done, but are a jerk in the process, is actually getting the job done. You might be able to meet your quota, you might be able to fulfill your job description, but along the way, if you're destroying relationships, man, it's not worth the baggage, it's not worth the body bags to get the job done. So you need to begin to develop the kind of self-awareness to recognize the weight you carry as a leader. That your facial expressions matter. Is it petty? Yes. But don't be blind to the fact that your facial expressions affect the people who are working with you. If you think it's something, I mean, somewhere like in the high 80s% of communication is nonverbal. Like only something like 7 to 10% of communication is your words. It's tone, it's facial expressions, it's body posture and movements. All of that is having an effect on every relationship you have. Are you moving that relationship? Are you keeping that relationship sacred and safe? Because here's the deal, you won't every day. I mean, I like it when I'm at my best at work. It's just not every single day. And when you're in meetings, when you're in conversations, you need to recognize the weight of your words. If you're a higher, like let's say you're the most powerful person in the room by position, okay? Which is, by the way, the positional leadership, that's the lowest form of leadership. But it is leadership, okay? You're the most powerful person in the room. You need to recognize your words way more than everybody else. Use them wisely. There's been times where it's like, with my dad, hey, Dad, you are absolutely right, but if you say it, you'll crush somebody. Let us say what needs to be said so that the weight of those words are the appropriate level for the relationship. And if you're just blind to that, but you're accomplishing the job, are you really accomplishing the job? Or you might be able to accomplish the job, get the contract, get that client or whatever. But are we doing something that when Pastor Dwayne, when he just said this last session, when 1 Corinthians 3 happens and all of our work is tried by fire, is securing that client or getting that contract really going to survive that kind of fire if you were a jerk and ungodly in the process or manipulative? Okay, so your attitude and your behaviors are having an impact. Do you even know what those are? And do you have enough safety in a relationship to put yourself out there to your closest teammates to say, how am I coming across? I'm giving you permission to look into me, to reflect back to me what you see. Yeah, your tone in that meeting the other day, it was sharp and it hurt people's feelings. If I get that kind of criticism, what will my temptation be? Fine, I'll just never talk in a meeting ever again. Or, you know what? They're just pansies. They just need to get over it. Now, maybe they're oversensitive and they need to get over it. But does it justify us being jerks in the process? Come on, you're leaders. Leaders find people where they are and bring them where they need to be. If they're oversensitive and touchy, get a face-to-face relationship that is full of love and safety and trust, and then say so. Okay, and this is the big one. This is what I'll just take the rest of the time on. The third thing. The person, because, okay, so let's break this down just for a second. Your organization, your nonprofit, your church, it has a purpose. Well, I hope so. If you don't, you need to get one. A purpose, a vision. It has strategies, values. It has systems and technologies and processes and procedures. But those are not what a business is. Those are not what a nonprofit is. What it is are the people. The people. I mean, just think about it at church work, okay? Have you been to a church that has all the right statements on the walls? Maybe all the right systems and processes. Maybe they look very excellent. But you walk in and you feel something, and what you feel doesn't look like what you're reading on the walls. Like churches, everyone's welcome. And then you walk in and you realize, except you. So So you can have all the right words, you can have all the right strategies and slogans and all that kind of stuff. You can make your billboards awesome. But who you are, that's what an organization is. That's what a nonprofit is. That's what a church is who you are. And who you are is the network of relationships that inhabit that organization. And when I talk about a network of relationships, that's extensive. You know, on my team, there's 7 of us. That means there's me and 6 other receptors of a relationship. That means me alone, I have 6 relationships. But on that team of 7, every one of us has 6 relationships. So look at how the manifold effect of those relationships. And on our team of 7, when one person is off, it affects everyone. And that's the pain of team, is to figure out how to keep moving and never turn away from those relationships when that one teammate's having a bad day. Okay, so number 3. The person, the teammate, the employee, the client, the vendor, they are a human being and should be treated as such. There's a whole chapter in Pastor Duane's book on identity theft where he helps you distinguish that your role is not your identity. And so many times we put ourselves, our whole identity in our role. Executive, pastor, chief salesman. We put our identity in our role. And when something starts to fluctuate with our role, what do? We freak out. We're grasping. What does that do to any relationship? When you are trying to secure your position because you are insecure as a person, it poisons the environment. Poisons the environment of the relationship. So you need to recognize you are a human being. And understand when you're being treated that way or when you're being treated just based on your function. And then as a leader, you need to, if I'm going to keep safety in this relationship, if I'm going to keep this space sacred, I need to treat the other person as a human being, not just their function. And this is where rubber meets the road. This is where it gets hard, because you're getting that in principle. But this environment, when it comes to managing employees, which is not an easy endeavor, right? I mean, how many people have someone you are directly overseeing in your work environment? Okay. That's not easy, is it? And I imagine they're very human, right? Which means they say and do dumb things. And you hired them for a position that has responsibilities, correct? And so how are we to treat that person? Like a person, primarily. And maintain this face-to-face relationship. Okay, so what do I mean by that? The way we manage people is, generally speaking, it's either fear or love. There's a little bit of shame in there with fear. Sometimes we use fear of shame. But there is a tendency as a leader to use people as an it and not treat them as a person. They are this function, and when they're not doing that function, I either have to manipulate them or I have to coerce them to do their job or else. And so we're either treating people like objects, it, or like people. People are not in service of your vision, your company. We are in partnership to do something that glorifies God. Now, it isn't to say, in keeping this face-to-face relationship, you ignore all the bad behavior. That's the opposite of love. Again, if this space is full of love, and what this other person is doing or saying is poisoning the environment or not fulfilling their responsibilities, that's still not good, right? So what would love do? Address it. You do that with your kids. They're saying and doing things that are hurting their future. What do? You address it. How you address it is what makes this space either sacred or poisonous. Do I use fear tactics? Do I use manipulation because all I want from them is their job, they're to do their duties, and if they don't do their duties, they're just a waste of time and money, so I dismiss them? It isn't to say that you can fire no one ever. No, sometimes you got to throw Jonah overboard, okay? Sometimes what the other person is doing is so poisonous to the environment that they do need to be dismissed. How so, though? With dignity, with respect. This is a human being made in the image of God with a divine purpose on this planet, with a unique set of gifts and callings, and they are falling significantly short of that. How would you want to be treated if you were in that place? Now, if they make decisions that do not bring them into alignment with what we're creating, yeah, they've made the decisions to move on. And you're just handing that final decision over to them. But how often do we use that as an excuse to not deal with the issues? Now, I have overcome a significant illness. Scientifically, it's called being a wuss. As I grew in leadership responsibilities, I realized I have to address things. I don't just get to skirt around them like I used to be able to do when I didn't oversee employees. And all of a sudden, now I'm responsible for this, and that person, they're doing something that's contrary to our mission, contrary to our values and culture. But I lack the courage to deal with it, so I'm going to go pray that Jesus will deal with it. And then the behavior worsens. And then, oh man, I really hope Jesus takes care of this. He needs to hurry. No. And so I had to muster the courage to learn how to stay face to face when I know I will. I mean, okay. If you've ever had anybody ever had a performance conversation, a do better talk. What do you think is going to happen when you go to address that behavior? What do you think their initial response is going to be? Defensive. You already know what I'm talking about, right? So if you know that, how do you normally respond to defensiveness? More defensiveness. Posturing. Who's got the higher authority? Who's got more power? I sign your paycheck. What are we doing to that relationship? We're treating them like an object when we do that. So when I know they're going to be defensive, because that's what I would be if you call me on behaviors, I'm going to probably get defensive, and I'm pretty skilled with my tongue. I know how to wiggle my way out of it. I know how to turn it back on you. If I'm keeping the space sacred, I already know how they're going to respond, so I've already prepared my heart for it. And they may turn it back on my leadership, so I've already prepared my heart for it. Because I refuse, by the grace of God, I'm going to have the courage to stand in this relationship. And when I get nothing but defensiveness or visceral anger, I'm going to stand and I'm not going to turn away. When every muscle in my body is wanting to just run away, or everything in me wants to posture over. And so for me, what I had to start doing is I had to know, okay, what do I want? I want this person, I don't want just their behavior fixed. I want them to buy into what we're doing with a good attitude. They're going to get defensive. They're probably going to turn it back on me. But what do I want? I want their best. I'm going to treat them with dignity. So what I just had to start, and I've said it out loud one time, but nearly every conversation I know I'm going into that's very uncomfortable, I've made a commitment, I will outlast you. You're going to want to turn away, and I've said numerous times, we're going to deal with this, and I've shut the door, and neither one of us are walking out unless we have to pee or we've resolved this. And we as leaders have to make that commitment to the people who follow us. That creates the sacred space that gives God a chance to manifest and be glorified in ways we couldn't even imagine. And so what you and I need to do as leaders, committing to teamwork, is have the kind of commitment to treat each other like human beings, to respect one another, but to have the courage and the guts to deal with hard issues, but keep the environment with love, even if in love you're having to bring correction, and even if that correction turns back on you. You're right, I failed you. You're right, I did not handle that correctly. Currently, that's not the issue. When we've dealt with the issue, we'll deal with my issue. But this is still the issue. Okay, the issue's dealt with. Now, how can I improve as a leader in your life? To empower you better. To give you better feedback. To be more grateful real time rather than always after the fact. And if you and I can create sacred spaces in these relationships, and then those network of relationships are all sacred, man, imagine what God could do in a whole community when just 5, 6, 10 businesses, when just one superintendent, or just one school teacher, or just like 2, maybe 3 politicians would be great, at local level government, are committed to that, what would happen to our cities? The church, pastors, the church needs to lead the way. We need to be the best leaders in our communities. Not in any way kind of showmanship, but because we model what it's like to reveal Jesus' love, that I'm going to commit to loving face-to-face, sacrificially, eternally. My love is not going to be based on people's behavior to me. And I'm going to love with humility. I'm going to go under and I'm going to serve. And I'm going to keep those face-to-face relationships that create a sacred space for God to work in just incredible ways in our cities. Amen?